Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 200 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Getting to Know You, Getting to Know All About Glenn Squires, a conversation I had with my boss, CEO of the Washington Grain Commission. Glenn and I have spoken here before about issues confronting the wheat industry. See episode 103, entitled Glenn Squires Lives, Breathes, and Talks Wheat. But in this, the 200th episode of Wheat All About It, I wanted to give listeners a flavor for the man behind the title. For instance, did you know Glenn drove tractor trailers as a young man and managed a large trucking firm before he went back to school to fulfill his undergraduate requirements? Or what about his love of a good horse? He was placed upon his first horse at age 2, and he has never been without one nearby since. His now 16-year-old Arabian, christened Rocket Socks, is stabled in back of his Spokane Valley home, and the two of them still go out on rides together. Here's another one. Did you know Glenn is a terrific dancer? I learned this from former Grain Commission CEO Tom Mick, who told me of witnessing our own wheat dancer at a function which included Glenn's wife, Charlotte. Alas, I have never witnessed the scene myself. Glenn's a family man. He and his wife, Charlotte, have 5 children and 8 grandchildren and counting. Although he only recently retired from leadership positions with the Boy Scouts of America, the organization was an important part of his life. He was an Eagle Scout, and all of his sons were Eagle Scouts. As an adult, he was not only a scout leader, but also organized large scouting jamborees. Not long ago, he and Charlotte were awarded the Silver Beaver, one of Scouts' highest recognitions for volunteers. In the office, I often call Glenn Boss, as in, "Morning, Boss," because I think it's important for me to remember where the buck stops. As CEO, Glenn's the guy who has to satisfy the 10 commissioners who serve as board members of the commission, while I only have to satisfy him. I think my job is far easier, but the fact is, my boss thrives on the challenge of helping implement the vision of his bosses, not to mention stomping out innumerable brush fires that are almost a daily distraction of helming an agency with so many connections to such a diverse audience. Let me just name some of those connections. Washington State University, the Wheat Marketing Center, the Federal Grain Inspection Service, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, the Washington State Department of Agriculture, the media, the Pacific Northwest Waterways Association, the Corps of Engineers, the Washington Association of Wheat Growers, U.S. Wheat Associates, Congress, the Oregon and Idaho Wheat Commissions, elevator and export companies, millers and bakers in an array of countries, and I'm sure the boss will remind me of a few more after hearing this. Another way to put it is that the WGC has a lot of fingers and a lot of pies, and at the direction of the board, Glenn Squires is the guy who turns policy into action. Which is why I thought it would be nice on this, the 200th episode, to ask and answer the question, who is Glenn W. Squires? I began our conversation by asking Glenn to tell me about his youth growing up in Centerville, Utah, and later working on the farm his father bought in nearby Mona.
My father had been a Navy pilot flying off aircraft carriers over the South Pacific during World War II. He came home, married a sweetheart, and would have loved to farm full-time, but he needed a job to support the farm, right? So he took a position at a print shop, bought some acreage in Centerville with fruit trees, and you know, there was a truck garden. And he also had interest in mushrooms. So I grew up surrounded by growing things, including horses and some livestock, even raised my share of calves during FFA. In junior high, my father bought a little farm in Mona, about an hour and a half away from Centerville. We raised mostly hay and dryland hard red winter wheat. We even had some triticale, actually. There were 7 children in our family. I was number 6. My mother was a housewife, but much more than that, she ran a small business called the Good Neighbor Co-op. She was way ahead of her time, very much into eating healthy. The whole family was involved because she would get things like carob and cashews, sunflower seeds, dates, raisins, you name it, in bulk, and we'd sort and pack it into small portions, and then she'd sell it. So I can tell you one thing. In an era when Wonder Bread ruled, nobody wanted to trade lunches with me. Not only did my mother make her own bread, she ground the wheat. The bread was dark and whole grain, of course, and sandwiches were filled with things like goat ham, goat cheese, sprouts. I even got goat milk in my thermos.
With all that health food, how long did your mother live?
She was 90 years old when she passed.
Okay, so where did you go to high school?
So I went to high school in Bountiful, a town next to Centerville. Our senior FFA project was to build a greenhouse next to the school. I believe it's still standing. After high school, I got an associate degree in transportation management and business management, and I actually eventually drove for a company and then ended up managing it. We covered 11 western states.
Uh-huh. Now, I remember once when we were traveling together, you telling me about hauling three, that is, triple trailers behind a single rig. What did you call that?
Wiggle wagons. You got to stay on your toes when you're pulling three trailers, triples. Boy, you just don't look in the mirror.
And you once had a pretty major accident, didn't you?
Yes, it was an accident. Somehow, I can't remember why, but a truck was left without a driver, and I had to ferry it back to the terminal. It was a cab over. I was going about 60 miles an hour around a soft bend when the left front wheel fell off, came right off the spindle. The investigation reasoned that it was likely sabotage. There was an independent trucker strike going on at the time. I don't know how that tire actually kept from hitting oncoming traffic, but it didn't. The truck, went into the median, jackknifed. It was winter. Fortunately, the ground wasn't super hard. The truck and the cab, it slid to a stop. The momentum just was sucked right into the ground. But once it stopped, I came out of that cab as fast as I could, and I ran for something like 50 yards to get up behind a overpass pillar because I didn't have a scratch on me, but I think I was in some shock. I was sure that truck was going to explode. Isn't that what happens in the movies?
Yes, it always happens in the movies. Wow, close call. Was that when you decided to leave the trucking industry?
No, that was several years later, and really my decision was about wanting to get into something agriculturally oriented. I didn't know what it was going to be or how I'd find it, but I felt the first thing I needed to do was to finish my degree. I went back to school at Utah State University and got a double degree major there in ag business and business administration with a food marketing minor.
And now somewhere in there you married Charlotte, right?
Yes, she's been very supportive of my career. It was tough there when we were going to school and parents of small children.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you got your undergraduate degree. How did you decide to go on to get your master's?
I just felt I had to get more education to secure the sort of job I really wanted. So in 1989, with three children in our car, we packed our bags and came to Pullman, specifically Valley Crest, actually the married student housing up behind Holbert Hall.
Uh-huh. And how did you choose WSU?
I had applied to Texas A&M and was accepted there as a student in their range science program. Meanwhile, I had also applied to WSU, was accepted there in ag economics with an emphasis in international marketing. So it was actually a tough decision, but I've got to say that WSU excelled at recruiting. After I came up for a visit, Ken Cassavant stayed in touch. Even the chair of the department called. I, I didn't get anything like that from Texas. WSU was just more aggressive, and I think that's made all the difference, hasn't it?
It really has, yes. You got to know Ken Casavant at WSU. For those who don't know him, he's got a PhD in agricultural economics, but most people think of him as a transportation economist. I think it's fair to say that in Eastern Washington, he's the guru of transportation analysis, right?
That's right. And, you know, Ken was a major influence on me. You know, all of the professors there in the Ag Econ department, tremendous, tremendous people. Of course, being in the Northwest, you know, we scrutinize the entire transportation infrastructure of the region, including barge and rail and even truck. Although I didn't know it in the beginning, actually my master's was really preparing me for this job with the commission.
Yes, yes, and it's really through a connection with Casavant that you got to know about the Washington Wheat Commission, right?
Yes. Tom Mick, the CEO before me, was looking for somebody to do a study about the influx of Canadian wheat that was pouring into the U.S. Tom reached out to the WSU and Ken for analysis on the issue, and as his graduate student, I did the research. This occurred about the same time that the Wheat Commission had decided to hire an in-house analyst. Tom hired me, you know, my title became analyst.
Now, you have five children. Tell me about them.
Sure. Caleb's the oldest. He's doing postgraduate work at the University of Sydney in Australia in weed sciences. Lyle is a manufacturing engineer and a company in Post Falls. My daughter Katie is in Albuquerque, where her husband works for a power line company. Dallin works as a financial analyst for a large transportation company, and Sylvan is in college, also getting his degree in manufacturing engineering.
Wow, smart kids. And all four launched with one in the countdown mode. That's great. Now, here at the WGC, we've been in COVID-19 lockdown since last March. Although I've been in the office to pick up mail and organize some work, I've largely been working from home. After a month working from home, however, you started coming back into the office. Why?
I did work from home initially, but I've been coming into the office since April. We were fortunate, actually, that our building can accommodate the COVID protocols. I find I'm more efficient being around the resources that the office provides, files, computers, copiers, you know, also caring for the property, you know, those types of things.
I admit I've missed coming in. The WGC office is a great place to work, and I'm really grateful the commission found this building and purchased it in 2009. It's a terrific space.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. It's not only perfect place for our commissioners to conduct business. It's an impressive space for meeting with trade teams and industry partners.
How would you describe office operations since COVID?
I've been very pleased with how the staff has stepped up to fulfill their duties at home under these circumstances. As you mentioned, there are periodic office visits and some staff rotation occurs. Obviously, there are synergies and energies that come from interoffice interactions, but you know the same advantages that apply to face-to-face discussions with importers, millers, bakers, also apply to our team here at the office. Ultimately, communication is the key.
Any idea when we'll be back at the office?
I would just be guessing if I gave you a date. I don't know.
All right. So, Glenn, you've worked hard to transition to virtual meetings, and the ones I've been involved with have seemed to go very well. In fact, it appears that in some presentations, we are connecting with more people overseas than we would have during in-person sessions. What do you think will happen to virtual technology when things return to normal?
It is true that some of these virtual calls have been with 200 people. And so as much as I prefer face-to-face meetings, the meetings we've conducted by webinars, as well as within our own virtual network, here at the WGC have proven themselves. I can't imagine that we'll go back to, you know, business as before, but it is likely that the future will find virtual meetings as well as in-person meetings. I think that that's what will happen.
So, are you raring to get back on airplanes?
I don't think it's the airplanes that I've missed. It's the access to our customers. Not to mention finding out about little issues before they become huge. Sometimes that happens, you know, in a face-to-face conversation. Social interactions, business interactions go hand in hand. You know, as I think about this, when I go to the Philippines, Japan, Korea, any of our important customers, there are days of meetings, and then there's evening dinners and get-togethers where I have to say that discussions of the day are clarified, strengthened, solidified. The whole issue, actually, is finding the best way to interact with our customers given COVID. I will say that it's just as important that we figure out how best to make connections with our legislators and our agency representatives, not to mention industry partners at the state and national level, given COVID. So the long and short of it is that the future will not likely be all in-person or all virtual. I'm pretty sure there will be a hybrid of the two. And as farmers know, hybrids tend to perform better in the field.
Yes, yes, they do. So, Glenn, can I ask you if you have any favorite podcasts?
Sure, I always enjoy the podcasts that feature U.S. Wheat staff and incredible work they do overseas. You did a podcast with Joe Sowers, U.S. Wheat Vice President, who lives in Manila. It was fascinating. So was the recent two-parter with U.S. Wheat President Vince Peterson. I also enjoyed the two podcasts you did with Andy Juris and Steve Henning, farmers on the younger end of the spectrum, talking about farming and their family legacies. Really, there's too many to name.
Good, good. So, Glenn, I've been around the commission either as a reporter or on staff for 30 years. Woo! I've seen some commissioners serve 1 3-year term and exit. I've also seen commissioners who have served 4 terms or 12 years. How would you characterize the farmers and industry representatives who serve on the board?
That's a good question. I believe that each individual who serves brings a unique skill set to the board. Serving as a commissioner is not just a title. It's a huge commitment of time and energy, and one that our commissioners take very seriously. I would like to give a particular shout out also to our commission industry representatives. Not every state has individual reps on their commissions, which I believe is too bad, because they're a huge asset. Damon Phelan, for example, manager of Tri-Cities Grain, will be leaving the board at the end of his term in December and will be missed. I've traveled with him as we've met with buyers, government officials in a number of countries. He's extremely knowledgeable, well-respected, engaging with our customers very well, and is a great asset with his conversation and experience in discussions at the board level. One of the things I've learned during my time associated with the Grain Commission is that the board is not stuck in the past. They have always been forward-thinking and committed to improving the industry as they represent the farmers from their districts. And I can't say enough about the staff here at the commission. We work as a team to support the commissioners.
Okay, okay. A policy question, Glenn, before we tie things up. The issues we cover, even our customers, have changed significantly over your time with the Grain Commission. But with a brief reprieve in the early 2000s, breaching the dams on the Snake River has remained a hot-button issue. Although the outcome of the latest environmental impact statement was positive for wheat farmers, you'd have to be naive to think it would be the last word. Where do you think dam breachers will aim next?
Well, you never know, but I have a hunch that one of your podcasts you did may point to the target. It was the one where you toured Lower Monumental Dam.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that. Episode 123 and 124, it was called LOMO, the Apollo 11 of Snake River Dams.
Right. That podcast was revealing of the efforts of the Corps of Engineers to keep Snake River Dams, any federal dams, operating at peak efficiency. Now, there are federal dams all over the U.S., much older than the four Snake River dams. But Lower Monumental, as your podcast pointed out, is 50 to 51 years old. Anybody who owns an older car, and I still own the first truck I purchased in high school, will tell you that as machines age, they require maintenance. The Snake River dams are all in excellent shape, but maintenance is required to keep them that way, and that does cost money. So Congress has consistently provided the funds necessary to maintain the federal dams and navigation infrastructure up and down the Snake Columbia River. Of course, it's important to remember that there are a number of public and private dams above the four Snake River dams. The reason I mention that is it's ironic that the target of breachers are the four Snake River dams, all of which have fist passage capabilities and extremely high salmon survival rates. While nothing, little to nothing, is ever said about the dams on the Snake or Clearwater rivers that have no fist passage capability, zero passage. The Lower Snake River and Lower Columbia dams, meanwhile, literally serve as the wheat farmer's highway to the ocean. And that doesn't begin to take into account the millions, even billions of dollars more in electricity generated, clean energy, which enhances Washington's profile as one of the lowest carbon-producing states in the nation. I think that needs to not be lost. Meanwhile, the dams are often referred to as run-of-the-river dams, but there's still a role they play in flood control, and that's often lost in the discussion. I've not seen any indication that the proponents of breaching will give up on their goal of rendering the Lower Snake River dams useless. And I contend that they'll then go after the Columbia River dams. I do want the industry and those who fund the WGC to know that we and our partners will also never give up on our efforts of maintaining transportation on the river as one of the federally authorized uses of the river system, while continuing to support efforts to increase salmon numbers.
All right. So, Glenn, anything you'd like to add here?
I hope that those listening to the podcast over the last 4 years have come to better appreciate just how complex this industry is and how hard all of us associated with it are working to maintain the values and infrastructure of this region and the crop we love.
I've got to say, I agree with Glenn. It pleases me that I help represent a crop that has not only helped the planet grow into today's diverse civilization, but has done it in such an array of delicious choices. As I've said before, and I'll say again, wheat provides an average of 20% of the world's calories, and versatile is its middle name. I hope you enjoyed episode 200, or what I entitled, Getting to Know You, Getting to Know All About Glenn Squires, the CEO of the Washington Grain Commission, and my boss. I hope you join me here again next week for another episode of Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in its head. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.